Hello, friends. Welcome to the End Evil podcast. This is Chris Jansen. Evil is the destruction of freedom. Really excited to bring tonight's show to you. This is a recorded conversation I had with Douglas Martin about 2 weeks ago. He's just a great researcher, a big inspiration to me when I first got started and all along the way. And so with no more ado, I'm proud to bring this to you. Quick reminder, check out endevil.life. I'd love it if people help donate to the show, or you can sign up for the newsletter and I keep you updated. There's a lot of big things coming. A lot of folks like to watch on YouTube, and if you're on YouTube, subscribe to my channel, please. And I'll see you guys in the chat. Here goes the show. Hello, this is Chris Jansen. Welcome to the End Evil podcast. Welcome to another fantastic episode where we're exploring natural law, truth, and freedom, and trying to relate to the people out there that evil is the destruction of freedom and all forms of evil that destroy our rights and our choices are what's holding back humanity from living a more prosperous and joyous life. And we can see all through history and all through time, this scourge of authoritarianism, collectivism just keeps haunting us as a people. And I'm really proud to share with you my guest today, Douglas Martin. He's been doing some incredible work over the years, and he was one of my original inspirations. And welcome, Douglas. Thanks for joining me today. I was just reviewing your work from way back in the Seed 2 conference, or Seed 1, too, and checking out your work on the origins of secret societies, and you do so much great work. I know you just got done doing some work on music with Ivan and Francesco, and I'm looking forward to checking that out. But thanks for joining me this morning, Douglas. Welcome.
Thanks a lot, Chris Jansen. I really am happy to be back on here with you. It's been too long. So yeah, we got a lot to talk about. And I just wanted to say that I was really impressed with your efforts at the Funnel 4 conference. Very uplifting, very inspiring to see new speakers in there. Such a powerful message, such a high standard of aesthetic and tech, and everybody stepping up their game. So many great speakers, including some new speakers that I wasn't familiar with. I got a lot of inspiration out of that. And I'm glad to see you're still doing it. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to having a good conversation with you and hopefully coming back on in the near future and doing some more follow-ups on this show, because we're going to open up some advanced topics and try to bring some clarity to some of these difficult subjects. Yeah, so it's great to be here.
The timing's good, too, because right before the Funnel Conference on the podcast, we were working through symbolism. Symbology was what I called it, the study of symbolism. And that was when you and I started corresponding. And I just knew that, you know, once I laid the foundation for symbolism and studying symbols, that it would be great to have you on and kind of get deeper into some of these topics. Folks, if you want to look back, scroll through andevil.life, and there were easy 5-6 episodes on symbology, studying symbolism. I did a great one with Brandon Martin as well. And we had Nate Kapp. And you can always find a lot of work from a lot of the history of Douglas's work on Nate's website, or Seed Truth Academy, which is Brandon's website, or cubbyhole.com. And that's cubbyhole with a W-H. And I'll share that link during the show when we go on it. But just to get things going, a topic I've been particularly interested, like I said, symbology, symbolism. And when I've been doing my own writing recently, Douglas, I've kind of been saying that I think the study of symbology and understanding metaphors is a survival thing at this point for humanity. And so I'm curious to see how that strikes you, the importance of symbology as a survival tool in today's world.
Okay, well, you're absolutely right about it. And I know there's some confusion about why it's so important. And there's some confusion about what the importance of the past is. And there's definitely some limitations on people's perspective of remote antiquity. But that's exactly what inspired me to get back on your show, was all the great work that you've done covering the symbolism. And that has really compelled me to try to get back on here and help bring some clarity to some of these difficult subjects. There's a lot there to talk about, and I do understand where some of the general confusion is. So I'm hopefully going to be able to help explain some of those things. I want to let everybody know that I have a new show coming out with Nate Kapp. We did it on Monday. This will be the third show I've done this week. And then I've got another soundtrack episode coming out, Full Immersion, with Francesco Sani and Ivan Oyola Jr. That'll be coming up next week or so. So two of those two shows will be coming out, and then hopefully this show on top of that. And then hopefully I'll be a little bit more regular back into the scene here. And it's really good to be on here with you, Chris. So I'm really excited to open this subject up. So yeah, let's dive right into it.
Yeah, I always feel like these matters of truth and freedom, it's like sustaining to the soul to talk about them with other folks and just get our word out there. It's somehow, during the years when I first started discovering just how dark our world is, it leaves you with this feeling of guilt and frustration. And but once you start talking about it with other people, in broadcasting the solutions, which is to understand what's going on, there is some level of feeling better about it to an extent, that at least our place in it, that we are projecting out like, hey, we don't like this stuff. We don't want to be part of a slavery system and a collectivist system. And one of the biggest things I think about your work that really jumps out for me is you help illuminate just how far this all goes back. And just how real it is in terms of how many different iterations we've seen of control systems, and also the misconceptions around secret societies. You know, I think there's a general misconception with the term the Illuminati and such, that mystery schools were bad things, when I think in truth, partly what I learned through your work is that oftentimes in history, the mystery schools were people trying to enshrine and keep these occult, these things safe, because you were risking your life in many cases in authoritarian systems in history by speaking up about freedom. For instance, in a kingdom where there's a king and you say, hey, everybody's a king, you know, you got a good chance of getting your neck cut off, right? So this has been a dangerous topic all through time, wouldn't you say?
It absolutely is, and it's definitely misunderstood. So I want to try to help bring some clarity to that. This could be a little long-winded, but let me just try to address what you've already just said there. Where classical history begins is basically the end of an era of theocratic monarchy. So you have democracy emerging in Greece. And so the democracy is the Greek ideal, and then you have republicanism emerging in Rome. So the republic, or the idea of a republic, is a Roman ideal in that respect. And we see, we have the rise and the fall of the Roman Republic, which leads to the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, which leads to the rise and the fall of the Holy Roman Empire, starting with the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. And basically at that point, the government takes control of what is to be the orthodoxy and attempts to unite Europe under this single banner of Latin Christendom. And then we enter into this dark age where there's so much ambiguity and so few scribes that it's hard to get scholars to agree on what is the bona fide history. And it's, there's a lot of reasons it's a dark age, because it's a barbaric time. There's very little known about it. But following the end of the dark age, we reach the height of the papacy. And the reason for that is that means that after about the 11th century, the papacy begins to go into decline. And then that leads to the emergence of the Renaissance. And so the papacy at that point, it has to up its own game and become more sophisticated. So that's basically what the idea of the Jesuits is about, you know, during the Dark Age, their priest class, their monks, they were the only ones that were really educated above the masses. And most of their knowledge was in Latin. So unless you were reading and speaking Latin, which was restricted to their clergy, you didn't really have access to knowledge during that time. And then once the Renaissance happens, what that means is that the Eastern knowledge and the older knowledge, the older traditions were restricted in the West. So what's going on in the East in Byzantine, it differs from what happens in the West through that dark age, because the Eastern knowledge is being restricted in the West. But see, the Renaissance kind of denotes that this knowledge is now starting to arrive in the West. And then post-Renaissance, we get the emergence of these secret societies, starting with Rosicrucianism, and then ultimately the Masonic Lodge first being established in 1717. So here's the problem, though, is, you know, when we're, I'm trying to figure out how to expedite this, but once the knowledge, we're already in complex forms at the beginning of classical history, which means that the pure forms that came out of antiquity are already so complex to the point where there's a failure in the priest class, and it's not really understood even among the best minds. The knowledge at the beginning of classical history is already essentially a fallen, corrupted solar doctrine. And it's, you know, the pure forms have not really been understood anywhere else but in Egypt, and the rest of it has been scattered to the four corners of the earth. So once the older traditions start arriving in the West after the Dark Age, they're already complex forms. So that's what the big dilemma in secret societies today is they're handling complex forms. And the only way to really understand complex forms is to reconcile pure forms. There simply is no other way. So that's the whole dilemma with symbolism. You see, the idea of symbolism is that the high wisdom, the greatest body of human knowledge that was ever developed before it came corrupted, it took the longest to develop, and it really only occurred in Egypt. So,
well, how about like the, for instance, the tarot cards? I love tarot cards. I keep them with me in my vehicle, and I kind of study the images, and it seems like these images have these archetypal shapes that, you know, have been attributed to Trismegistus. I always get that name wrong, but, you know, the back Egyptian, maybe even previous. Sometimes there's a little bit of mix up between the Emerald Tablets, but I've heard some say even that there's some crossover between the tablets and these tarot images. But I think these symbols, these images that still stand and can still be interpreted today, it's kind of where my mind goes as the more pure forms, whereas it almost reminds me of what you're saying, like when I get into remodeling a house and you can see someone built something on the side of the house, and then someone else, some other owner came on and built something else on that, and you can see it's all cut up and weird and it doesn't make sense. But at the foundation, you know, there is some structure that all these things are built upon. And does that make sense? Am I saying it back in a way.
Well, it absolutely does, because the whole premise of the idea of Freemasonry, for instance, is building on a sound foundation. So in the profession of construction, you definitely have a better understanding than most people do on that, because you know we don't want to build on an unsound foundation, because it's just a matter of time before it starts to crumble. And that is what's happening in the world today. We're building on unsound foundations. The Greeks never understood the Egyptian. The Hebrews never understood the Egyptians. And the Hebrews had taken from the Babylons what was already a corrupted Egyptian. And then the Greeks took that from them, and Roman scholars have taken from the Greeks and passed that forward into modernity. So, yeah, we got to get back to pure forms, and that goes some ways back into remote antiquity, and it's not generally understood in any constituency or consensus or, you know, I mean, how do you know we have to exceed academia? Because academia embraces socialism, which by that I mean all forms of man's law, man's authority. So we know we got that academia is corrupted because it embraces socialism. But once we get out of, you know, once we penetrate pre-Christian Rome, then we're kind of in the catch-all of Neoplatonism, taking us all the way back to Babylon. Ideally, we're going to have to penetrate Babylon too, and that takes us back about 80,000 years, and it really goes farther back, but that's about where I see the corruption happening, and that's still during this, what I call a solar cult. We really have to understand we've been in this solar phase of the Egyptian mythos for 100,000 years, and that's predated by the 50,000 year lunar phase, and then, you know, back 300,000 years or more of the stellar phase, which is the early phase, which is where pure forms were discovered and preserved, and those correspond in the number 7 to the lesser mysteries. So I don't want to open up all of that right now, but I want to put the emphasis on we have to restore pure forms, because all of these religions and all of this dogma that we're living with in this world is a result of having gone into complex forms without any reconciliation or, you know, preservation of the pure forms, by which is the only means. We have to understand that the largest body of human knowledge predates language, and that language itself is basically the fall of the Tower of Babel, because it causes a reduction in the symbolism. The whole idea that the Christ spoke in parables is because he's trying to get you to activate the whole brain. He's not like the Riddler trying to riddle you into confusion. He's trying to get you to activate the whole brain. The whole brain must be engaged. So, yeah, go ahead. What else is on your mind? Because I know these are big subjects.
Here's an image I pulled out from your secret societies, I think part one, complex symbolism. You said, if a picture is worth 1,000 words, a symbol's worth 1,000 pictures. If a symbol is worth 1,000 pictures... a sigil is worth 1,000 symbols. If a sigil is worth 1,000 symbols, a talisman is worth 1,000 sigils. So, you know, I'm talking about symbolism and symbology. I've been trying to make the point that these are way, way more communication ability with symbols of all types than just words. And it's interesting to me that you brought up the Tower of Babel, because that's, to me, very interesting story I've always thought about from the Bible, that sort of describes this strange thing that I see happening in our real world right now, where language is being confounded even further with all this technology, that even though we have more forms of technology of communication than we've ever had, it's also harder to communicate than it's ever been. And I think it's partly due to people not understanding symbols and symbology. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about the different types of symbols there, the sigils, and how they're more powerful than words themselves.
Because to understand the symbolism, it forces you to scour out your internal faculties. You know, it's a symbol is essentially potentially inexhaustible. And we have to understand it in its pure essence, and then understand how that basically potentially could flower into a corrupted form. We have to, it's about understanding, you know, the real psychology of the human mind and understanding that the greatest body of knowledge that has been developed concerns our correspondence between our mental faculties and what we manifest in the physical world, because these things are basically happening in the same place at the same time. The spiritual realm is happening in the same place at the same time. And this is what was understood by the ancients. So everything that they're doing is trying to, because they understand that this is going to become an inconvenient truth if we slide into socialism and man's ambition to be the lawmaker. It's going to want to get rid of anything that, that challenges the dogma of its own claims. It's going to obliterate that. So everything that they're doing in the early cultures is trying to make a contingency to endure the ages of their earliest discoveries of pure forms of this knowledge before it unfolds into more complex forms. See, there's a phenomenon from where we start to develop and discover the knowledge. It's called the unfoldment. And the way that it is unfolded is the method. The way that it's taught and understood is the method. And that's what you could refer to as Freemasonry. So I realize that that's a stigmatized term. So let me just put a little bit of clarity on that, because there's a lot of confusion. So when we're talking about Freemasonry, we really need to make the distinction between the lodge or the order, whatever the particular order is, and then we need to distinguish that from its own alumni, its members, and then ultimately what we're really concerned about is what the tradition itself is. So once any institution emerges above sub rosa, above ground, it's going to be immediately infiltrated by special interest. So when we're studying the secret societies after the Renaissance, we're going to see that phenomenon happening. As soon as, it, you know, and that goes for all of the institutions, including the religious institutions, educational institutions. Every institution is corrupted by special interest as soon as it establishes, which are, you know, ambitions for man to be the lawmaker. Socialism is what it is. And that is not a left-right paradigm in the bigger picture. It's the belief in man's authority, because it's based in moral relativism and social Darwinism, you know, selfishness, hedonism as your self-preservation as your highest directive, and then ultimately leads to eugenics, which is thinking that you get to decide, or the government can decide who gets to live and who gets to die. And there's a lot to it. So these are all big subjects. But yeah, let's
yeah, your voice bones in my head. Who gets to live and who gets to die? Who's going to be king? You know, that's the big question, right? Like you talk about in that Nate plays that, I think, on the on his Outcasting. I think is that where I hear that? Anyway, it's a good point. You know, it's like that's been all through history. I've been studying weapons self-defense for the last couple years, and one thing my teacher has kind of explained to me is that historically a king comes through town and they need everybody to bow. Why is that? You know, he asked that question. Why do they have people bow? Well, when you bow, you know, you're exposing the back of your neck and you can't really attack the king when you're on your knees bowing. Right. And so like you're saying, contingency, he wants to make sure nobody's attacking him, you know, so everybody bows. It's not just respect, you know. In ancient feudal Japan or China, I'm sure, you know, when you bow against another martial artist, you keep your eyes on him because you know that, you know, all he has to do is pull that sword out and your head's chopped off. But I think this, you know, the ancient, I've really personally got a lot from your explanation of the Freemasonry initiate tracing boards. And the first one especially is the one I've studied the most. It shows the two pillars, Boaz and Joachim. I never... sure if I say Joachim right, but representing solar, the moon, and also I think of the self-defense principle on one side and do no harm principle on the other. And I think the missing pillar in our mentality of the modern world has been, you're not allowed to defend yourself. You bow before the king. You know, you're not allowed, in most places in the world, you're not allowed to have weapons. you know, you're, and many places, governments historically have not allowed people to train in self-defense. So that missing link, going how far back in history, I don't know, has prevented us from understanding any level of freedom because we can't defend ourselves because we don't even understand the principle. So I'd like to hear what you have to say on that.
Well, it's a big subject, and I would say that very few understand what the real reasons for this dilemma are, because it's really a much greater responsibility than what people really understand. But it's not within the rights of man to renounce the use of reason and voluntarily become a slave. So we have to understand that self-defense and self-preservation is a personal responsibility. When you put that into a collective, that's something different, because a collective has no conscience. It has no responsibility. It cannot be held accountable. The principle of self-defense and personal protection is an individual responsibility that has to be understood. And we, you know, that's what it's really about, you know, is understanding these principles so we can build on sound foundations. But you got to be careful because, you know, you have to be careful with militant posturing, for instance. You're not going to convince people that you're on a mission for a universal peace with militant posturing. But, you know, we want to outline what these pillars represent, which is, in a sense, the non-aggression principle and then the self-defense principle, which is the masculine prospect. See, because in the grand story of things, we've basically evolved or raised up through our infancy as a species, and we are in that phase where we're supposed to be reaching a maturity. And I noticed that maturity is about understanding how to deal with this masculine principle, which includes self-defense and personal responsibility. So one of the things I want to say about it is, once you have a technology, you can't really get rid of that. It's everybody's responsibility. Now, the thing about governments and systems of man's authority, the nature of government is to consolidate power. So in the founding of the United States, for instance, the founding fathers understood that. So everything, you know, of course, you had in the very early stages, you had the non-federalists that believed in basically no forms of man's government or authority, versus the federalists who wanted to create a minimal, small amount of man's government. And the main thing that they both agreed on was that if there was to be any system put into place, everything that they're endeavoring to do from that point is to create a contingency from that ever becoming able to centralize its power. And so the idea of a distributed force throughout the population is essential to that, because that's a contingency to prevent a centralized authority. And then states' rights is a contingency to prevent a centralized authority. And then the three tiers of the government, the judicial, the legislative, and the executive branches, are separated to prevent a centralized authority. The whole thing, the way the American Constitution was set up, first of all, it's based on a Greco-Roman idea, which is supposed to be a republic which enshrines a code of inalienable rights as a contingency against the Greek ideal, which is democracy, which is ultimately ruled by the most ignorant, to protect inalienable rights from being able to be voted away through an ignorant population. So it's a Greco-Roman ideal. It's basically supposed to be a democratic republic. But as you can see in just a few couple hundred years that we've slid pretty far away from what the original foundations are and how all of these things have been encroached, including through the degradation of language, because our language has degraded all the way to the point where good now could mean bad. And you got Michael Jackson running around singing, I'm bad, et cetera, et cetera. You know what I mean? So, yeah, go ahead, because that's what this is all really about.
Yeah, we did that Warriors episode, and we were talking about voting as violence. And, you know, it's interesting to me that the modern day person seems to think that their sword is their ability to vote. And I'm like, well, when have you ever actually changed something in your life or someone you know with that power that you supposedly have to vote? Have you been able to protect an innocent person or yourself or your rights with that? Because it doesn't seem like a very effective sword to me, you know? And I really think that when you project forward, if there were to be a change in people, we'd have to first understand these philosophies on a deeper level. And where people get stuck in conversation with me is, and I've heard you talk about this, oh, we're going to get destroyed by foreign invaders if we don't have a government, or we're going to, you know, the dangers of even thinking about not having an authoritarian system of control makes people quiver. And I think that's because they haven't gone back and studied these really basic principle, what you talked about at the beginning, these really simple concepts. So I'm going to bring up an image of that I took from one of your presentations with these tracing boards. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to talk a little bit about the two pillars and some of the things on these tracing boards that apply to this convo. Let's see here.
Yeah, I got it
right here. Window, screenshot, share. There it is. The one I've studied the most is the Entered Apprentice. Anything you want to say about these, I'd really appreciate to hear your wisdom.
Okay, well, you know, I can make a good point right here, because as most people know, there's basically two orders of masonry coming out of England, the York Rite and the Scottish Rite. And the York Rite essentially has 10 degrees. And the Scottish Rite, as we know, has 33 degrees and beyond, honestly. But in the original form, which is really Egyptian craft, the Egyptian sciences, you see there's only 3 degrees. And these have to do with, you know, individual stages of our own personal development, but also in the big picture of humanity as a whole and our evolution and our integrity as a species. So, as humanity, we are in the third degree, like it or not. And that means that we need to be qualified to understand complex forms, and we don't. So because we don't understand basic forms, which we'll find in that first degree, there's no way we can understand the complex forms that come with the third degree. And, we have to go through that middle chamber, which is an internal, you know, basically represents the shadow work. So we have to understand that, you know, the responsibility of Freemasonry as an established order is that it tried to preserve everything that was being demonized by the status quo or the Roman Church. And its responsibility was to open doors for all particular brands of faiths and allow them to access, you know, potentially older material that was trying to be obliterated by the status quo and further flesh out their own spiritual doctrines. So it's really supposed to be a place where people can unite on spiritual ideas and then further flesh out their own dogma or their own spiritual traditions. So there's a lot more to it.
But I think too often these, because Freemasonry or the stonemasons have a kind of this, we talked about, I mentioned before, there's a societal connotation at this point that's, oh, that's all bad or negative, you know, that's evil stuff, you know. And I'm like, no, the evil is the destruction of freedom. The Freemasonry, it seems, in the past, I don't know, you know, probably the years better than I did, but we know Weishaupt is a pretty big name that pops up. There was sort of a, it almost seems like a takeover of Freemasonry at a certain point in history where it did kind of become part of the evil cabal as a mechanism to change things. But it seems like these concepts in these, in the original teachings really point to spiritual truths and even towards the ultimate secret of natural law. Is that a correct way of saying it, Doug?
It's very accurate. And I couldn't have said it better myself, honestly. So with the phenomenon of Adam Weishaupt and the French Revolution, it's the same dilemma I was trying to explain. You know, they're trying to bring older, purer forms and Eastern traditions into the West. But see, they're already dealing with conventionalism, which is complex forms. So it's very hard to prevent the ambiguity from spreading. And then, see, ignorance is ultimately the adversary. And that's the adversary that we're all faced with. When we're in these complex forms, there's going to be so much ambiguity. We're never going to agree on anything. And that's what's going to allow dogma to flourish. That's what's going to allow postmodernism to flourish. And understanding how that's going to lead to these corrupted modern ideals like communism and fascism and any form of man's authority, essentially, but also dogmatic religion, because we really have to understand the world is controlled by religion. We have to understand that even though governments do back their policy or their dictates with force, the masses of the populations are controlled through mind control. And that's really what the word government actually means, is mind control. You know, mens mentis is mind, and gubernare, control. So to control the mind. I have to understand that our dilemma is much larger than what people realize. And therefore, the real solution to all of this is going to be much more grand of a task than most people realize. And the more we understand that, the more we're going to understand why people not only are not willing to do it, but in such a deplorable condition in the first place, because we have fallen and we have abdicated responsibility to these truths. But let me make this point, because one of the things that's happening in the early stages of the development of knowledge is they understand pure animism, and everything that they discover is imbued with a spiritual center. And the method is how to draw out a lot, you know, a lot of it has to do with how to understand how to draw out that spiritual center. But in the evolution, see, one of the things that's important about the weaponry or the implementation is because that's where a lot of the evidence of actual evolution takes place. You know, because you're going to see in the quest for truth that people will deny things that are right in their face and refuse to understand that this is how, this is real. The evolution is real. They want to tell you that history's been erased and it's just, you know, been reset every couple hundred years. You don't need to look into it, and it's just ridiculous. But here's how we understand this, or I'm going to try to help us understand this is, you know, for instance, hammer comes before bow and arrow. And that's recognized as a symbol of power. You know, the power comes from the hand, but with a hammer in hand, that's more power. And there's a lot more to all that. But if we understand that that precedes bow and arrow, we understand that the bow is a crescent, and that corresponds to a lunar prospect. And that predates sword, because sword is metallurgy. And the sword is an implementation that mimics Christian cross. And it is contained the five, because it has the four points plus the center. And that five is very significant. We're going to find out because it's really about the gods of the four corners and then the spiritual center. And just the main thing I'm trying to say is they spiritualized everything. So by the time we come into the modern world, we have this phenomenon of them trying to spiritualize chivalry. And that's kind of what the Arthurian legend is largely about. So in the Christian ideal, see, Christianity is
Arthurian, you mean Arthur?
Yeah, King Arthur. So Christianity is the pinnacle of the evolution of Egyptian mythology, but it's so corrupted and ambiguous in complex forms that it's become vestigial and misunderstood. Nobody understands these pure forms. So it's basically handing you an inert scientific implementation, which, as we know, is the Christian cross. And that's basically a symbol of its tradition. But in the Arthurian legend, they're handing you the sword. And that's, you know, because in the Christian traditions, they want you to recognize their intermediary. They want you to go through their intermediaries and their authorities to get to your creator. So they're creating, you know, that middleman, the intermediary for you to get a relationship to your creator. But the main point I'm trying to make is Christianity is the pinnacle of the Egyptian mythology, but it's so misunderstood, it's been literalized and historicized. In the Arthurian legend, they're handing you the sword of sovereignty, where you take responsibility for your own protection and your own understanding of the forces in nature and your own responsibility to truth and sovereignty. So they're threatened by that. And also the Arthurian legend can connect you to a pre-Roman Britain, which is a big part of the real solution, you know, because we have to first penetrate Britain, and then ideally we're going to have to penetrate Babylon to get out of this erroneous thinking and understand how these things have become so corrupt. And there's a lot more to say about all of this. We're just barely touching on these subjects. But I did
go ahead. It stimulates some thought in the listeners to look deeper. You know, like I said, go to cubbyhole.com and click on Doug, and you'll see 2-3 hour presentations on each of these topics that we're talking about, and you can go in a little more depth. But go ahead and finish your thought, Douglas.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that. And you don't have to think. It is called the Great Work, and it is difficult, and so few understand it that it's going to be hard to find the supporting research, but you really do need to persevere in your own work. But don't have to think of it as work, you know. Try to get some enjoyment out of it. Take pride in everything that you do, especially in your research, you know. But you really got to have some fun, or you drive yourself crazy. You got to live your life. But, you know, you're going to have to recognize how serious the problem is. And that's not a lot of fun. It's not a lot of fun to see, you know, people that you care about in a deplorable condition in their own development and arresting their development there. And the problems in the world just compounding and becoming more and more severe, which they will continue to do as long as we pursue man's law or socialism. It's only going to get worse. The only way we're going to turn this around is to really understand what has true value in this world and why. And it's in the endeavor to preserve our own sovereignty individually. But, you know, there's a lot more to say about, you know, government encroachment on our freedoms. The government doesn't have a right to take anything from anybody, because government doesn't have a right to exist. Government doesn't, in fact, exist. It's an entity. It cannot be held accountable. It has no rights. It has no conscience. It
has no heart.
It has no heart. It is, and it has no right to exist. It has no right to tell people, you know, but anything about how they need to live their lives, or anything that they can own or whatever. You know, it doesn't even have the right to exist. But we have to understand that once a technology exists, we have to take responsibility for it. We can't just, you know, make it go away. We have to take responsibility for it. And of course, the nature of government is the centralized power. So its ambition is always going to be to render a population defenseless against its monstrosity, you know, and it's going to continue to become more and more monstrous. And the phenomenon of the velvet glove coming off of the iron fist, I mean, it's usually an incremental process that people don't notice right away until it's too late. So we have to be forever vigilant. You know, that's the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. But understand, you know, by their ends that you will know their means. And their ends is control, to centralize power. So everything else that we see happening in the news or in the world is either trying to distract us from what they're trying to do, or it's slowly getting us warmed up to it. You know, by their ends, you will know their means. And their ends are absolute centralization of authority and power. So we have the responsibility of being eternally vigilant. Go ahead.
Yeah, they want to keep us focused on those shadows on the wall. So we stay firmly seated inside of Plato's cave and recognizing that there's a whole world of thought out there that transcends the mechanisms that we're stuck in. And I think I want to repeat something that you brought up that I think people often miss, and that is the importance of who's at the top of this pyramid of power. And the priest class is what you pointed towards. And I think that word even gets confused, but the idea of mind control, I've often thought about wars. What war did not involve massive amounts of propaganda to get it started? You know, I had a episode when we were working through symbols called The Most Destructive Symbols of All Time. And I talked a lot about the cross, like you were saying, and the sword. And I'm not saying it's the most destructive symbol of all time. I'm just pointing out that it could be. It could well be. And these symbols are not necessarily evil or bad in themselves. It's the psychology and the mind control that has been perpetuated around these symbols, using these symbols, so that, you know, the further generations the people see these symbols, they stand behind the flag, they put themselves on the battlefield to kill or be killed, and they're standing behind these sigils and symbols, which ultimately are leading back to the mind control, the psychological control over the masses to take action without sovereign personal integrity and thought of, is this actually moral to the universe, to what's natural inherently, rather than these people in charge right here and their, you know, their symbol, the sword or the hammer, or depends where we're in time, their bloody flag. It gets people to do things that they should never do. And that's that choice that people make to sign their soul away and join an army or fight for a king without understanding the symbols and why they're creating these symbols to manipulate you in the first place, is where it all kind of starts, right? And so how do we begin to not fall for this trap, you know? And that's where I'm getting in the importance of symbology, you know? And so that's not exactly a question, but I guess what I'm getting at is I'd like you to highlight a little bit more for people just how important it is to recognize where this all starts is also where it all ends, right? How we end evil is getting to the root of this thing, right? Getting to those simple forms and not being controlled.
That's well said. Yeah, we have to get back to pure forms. Ignorance is the adversary. So the task that we're faced with is much more grand because it's a quest for truth. And it's buried under a mountain of dogma in the modern world. So we've got a large task before us. You know, those that can make us believe in absurdities can make us commit atrocities, you know, and most of the genocide and carnage in the world is committed by people that genuinely believe they're doing the right thing. You know, in the Crusades, the mantra was God wills it, which is Deus Vult. You know, they literally believed that they were the good guys. And now we see that phenomenon in the police and military. They believe they're the heroes. I'm here to tell you, there's no paycheck in doing the right thing. Okay, so if you're on the government dole thinking that you're the hero, there's no paycheck in doing the right thing. Okay. We have to remember that the idea of the Christ, whether you have subscribed to historicity or not, in their own story, was killed by the police and the military under the decree of the state, because he was opposed to the state, and he was opposed to the violence of the state, which attempts to abdicate its personal responsibility for its, you know, the destruction that it causes. And it does that, by, you know, through the method of order following and trying to, you know, initiate a decree and then buffer the karma away from themselves by getting other people to follow their dictates and their orders. It's a big subject, so I don't want to take it lightly, but I wanted to say that these are difficult subjects as well. So let me say that as far as secret societies are concerned, there was an attempt in the Masonic order to prevent World War I. And we have to understand that the only way to really attain to a universal peace is to unite, or for the Brotherhood of Freemasonry throughout the world to unite on a universal principle. So because they're not united to the degree that it's going to have to take place, we have to understand what's creating the ambiguity. Now, at the beginning of World War I, the Western Lodges were making an appeal to the German orders to adopt a pacifist attitude towards the present danger. And see, there's these terms, and which I know the term pacifism is abhorrent, but we have to really understand that in from a collective, you know, perspective as well as an individual perspective, and understand that you're not going to get people, you know, to believe that you have a mission for universal peace if you're militant posturing. Or if, you know what I mean, it's going to be a difficult prospect to convince people that you've got, you know, that your ambition is a universal peace. But we need to understand with that subject, we need to understand these terms. And the idea of pacifism is a complete refusal or an opposition to violence or war. The idea of pacifism is a total opposition to violence or war. Of course, you know, to go deeper into that, we want to distinguish violence from force, which there's a lot more to. But there's another term that people probably aren't familiar with, and that's called pacifism. And pacifism is the complete opposition to violence or war unless otherwise deemed necessary. So because the Germans had adopted a pacifistic attitude during that early 20th century, it did lead to the beginning of World War I, and now we see what the result of that. It really still hasn't really even ended, because World War II was an extension of that, and the fighting continues today. The modus operandi is harder to see because it's balkanization. You know, so what that's about is trying to break up larger government structures and territories into smaller pieces so they can more easily install puppet dictators there that they can more easily control. So the modus operandi is balkanization. That's like the
Balkan, like with
balkanization.
The
yeah, the Balkans that were divided, you know, Austro-Hungary was divided into many smaller territories in the outcome of the World War One, and that's known as balkanization because it's about breaking larger, stronger territories into smaller pieces that can more easily be brought under a centralized authority. That's what the forming of the United States was about, was to get rid of the thousands of manors and private manors and turn that into 50 feudal territories, because 50 feudal landlords will be more easily brought under the centralized control of the central authority. It's all about that, you know. So the balkanization is a modus operandi to weaken a region by dividing it up and then systematically one by one installing puppet dictators that can be more easily controlled.
And also that they can be used to threaten people's comfort and safety, something we talked about last week.
Yeah, destabilization is the modus operandi as well. That's right. We see that happening in the Middle
East. They use terrorism, right?
That's why they wanted to get rid of Gaddafi, because Gaddafi was providing a sanctuary for people trying to flee Africa. And they were trying to get them to flood over into Europe. And they, you know, Gaddafi was giving them a sanctuary where they could try to rebuild their lives. They didn't want that. They want that immigration spilling over. They want destabilization on a large scale, because that's what creates problems. Job security, or that's how government sustains its existence, is by creating more problems. Every problem that we have today is legislated to exist. So they want more problems, because that's how government, you know, its first directive is self-preservation. So that's how it sustains itself, is to make the host dependent on the parasite. Sorry. But yeah, there's so
if
much.
If you had
a big subject, you know,
giant field of sheep, and, you know, you're the government and the sheep are your sheeple. You have a question at a certain point. The sheep are getting stronger legs over time. And they're able to start jumping the fences. Do we make the fences taller, or do we inject all the sheep with a potion to make their muscles less strong? Maybe we do both, you know, and you can kind of just, I do a comparison often to how we treat cattle or animal, which is terrible in many ways. But that's kind of the same thing that's been done and being done to populations, is how do we keep them contained? How do we keep them weak enough to where they can't work together to get out of the container? And that's a multifaceted approach. And it seems like it's been going on so long that people just are folding into that mistake over and over. And I see through history, I mean, I know you talked about the monk class or the people that I often think of, these people that studied martial arts, you know, in different times in history, China, Japan, even it would get kind of mixed in with certain religion aspects. But there were traditions in various places and times where people would train internal strength in the individual, and then knowing that that would help protect the whole town, you know, if need be. And there were times where military clashed with local gangs, you could say, but who's the big gang? It's the government, right? So ultimately, I feel like it's pointing towards is we need to take responsibility for our own bodies and the innocent ones around us, and learn how to protect them on a real world thing. So we have to understand this philosophy is, when is it right to stop some violence? You know, the movies, the shows, like I was talking about, we were just talking about, they present the anti-hero as taking revenge, as not being it's not self-defense if you're out there, you know, causing violence. You know, like, self-defense is pretty specific to defending rights, to seeing a problem happening and drawing a line and saying, if you cross this line, then I'm going to make sure that you can't keep doing that, right? And so I guess my question to you is, how do we begin to help people understand what has to be done realistically to start understanding this defense of individual rights?
Well, like I say, it's a personal endeavor. It's a personal responsibility. The Shaolin monks, they do train in discipline and self-defense, and they put that on display, you know. So but there's also a Gandhi quote you made me think of: a nation's morality can be gauged by how it treats its animals. And, you know, there's some truth in that, but that's also, you know, but ideally, we're going to have to unite on something that is genuine. And a lot of this idealism is either so ambiguous or so complex, nobody understands it. Ideally, the only thing that's really going to be our salvation is when we unite on truth. And the best place to start with that is to unite around natural law principles. recognize that self-defense, the only protection in the universe that is really provided to anybody, is their knowledge and understanding and alignment to natural law. As far as self-defense, that's a personal responsibility that we cannot abdicate or give away. Or when we start believing that somebody else can keep us safe, that's what causes the monstrosity of government to manifest in the first place. And by taking that attitude, we're allowing that monstrosity to grow around us and seek a monopoly on force and violence. And that's a very dangerous prospect. And the founding fathers of America did everything they could to prevent that from ever being able to happen. But there's a lot more to it, because we're going to have to really understand that the dilemma is more serious than what people understand. And I wanted to mention about leadership, you know, in general, that people should learn to understand that leadership is basically two prospects. And you can make it more complex and start breaking it down, but we need to understand it in the context of the idea of transformational leadership, which is basically leading by example and inspiring other people. And then the other form is transactional, which is punishment and reward. And that everything a government does with its population is based on a transactional prospect. Everything in our culture is based on a transactional prospect. That's why if you're bad, Santa Claus is not going to bring you any presents. And if you're good, he's going to leave some presents under the tree. That's a transactional prospect, you know. And then the government's the same way. If you don't follow our decrees, we're going to, you know, accost the violence of the state against you, cage you, and incarcerate you, and possibly kill you. But it's transactional. It's punishment and reward. So the idea of transformational is leading by example, and then transactional, punishment and reward. And every state decree is enforced through a transactional relationship. And, you know, we've opened up a lot of really, really, really big subjects. And I know we're not bringing a lot of clarity to any one particular subject. It's just kind of an in general discussion, kind of just opening up this subject to see, you know, how far we can get with it and how much we can get on the table.
Yeah, perhaps we can do a follow-up, Douglas, on this episode, and we could zone in a little more on some of the specifics. But, yeah, we've kind of just turned the hour for today. Why don't you just, as best you can, kind of sum up some of the things we've talked about and just send to the listener the points that you most want them to take away from this discussion.
Yeah, it's everybody's individual responsibility, and the infinite value of the human being is our capacity for understanding principles. That's what makes every unique individual, you know, the same in a way. That's where we're united on. That's where the infinite value of the human being is our capacity to understand principles. And then our integrity is based on our willingness to do so and find that care in ourselves to take that responsibility and understand that the material prospect leads us away from our true responsibility to truth. Understand that, you know, ideally, to unite as a species, we've got to care about the things in this world that matter the most. And those are the things that we need to really be trying to learn and understand and put more emphasis on and find our deeper care to do so. Understand that the world's become filled with dogma, and that's why everything is corrupted, and that's why nobody can agree on everything. And the only way we're really going to unite and break down those barriers is to unite on something, a sound foundation, and that's truth itself. And we have to understand where all this ambiguity comes from, where all this perplexity comes from. And that's not an easy thing to do. It's going to take a lot of hard work. And, you know, the question I asked in my last presentation was, what's it going to take to move men to truth? But ideally, I think we need to start with natural law principles. We need to recognize that religion, the idea of getting rid of religion is not a good idea, because that's one of the things I wanted to say on here today, was that the idea of religion in the first place was a rejection of atheism and a rejection of man's authority. So, you know, and then modern institutionalized religions, they carry kernels of truth that we're going to need to really find our way back to pure forms. But we wouldn't want to just throw those babies out with the bathwater, but understand why they're wielded as powerful political devices in corrupted forms. So that's why we have to take responsibility for that. And that's what the idea of secret societies is supposed to be able to be about, is a place that where we could have a sanctuary and gather enough of those ideas into one place so we can start to understand, you know, the comparative commonality and find the eclectic common kernels of truth to make the bigger tapestry of truth. There's a lot more to that, but
we
can do it if we, you know, care enough.
The cornerstone of the foundation is natural law. I think that's the way I like to look at it. And I did some work on the cornerstone. And, you know, if you look into early building, that was a really important aspect of finding square, you know, finding the corner, finding the right angle. And the right angle represents what's right, you know, what's true.
That's right.
And that's true everywhere in the world. A right angle is the same thing. You know, there's really no doubt about it. When you find it, you can measure 3, 4, 5, boom, there it is, you know.
Six, eight, ten,
same thing, you know, and that's universal. And there was something else you said that really got me excited. I wanted to repeat, you know, I thought a lot about, you know, I did that episode about Jesus and some of his parables, and you know, my favorite story of Jesus is in the square when he bakes a whip and forces the people out of the marketplace that were trying to monopolize the marketplace that was supposed to be a place of religion. But back, that's the other point I was going to come to. Religion, the word religare, is to bind, right? To marry. And when we do that in an exterior form, someone else tells us, oh, you need to bind to my idea, or you need to marry yourself to this storyline I'm giving you, as opposed to me saying my inner self-discipline, I'm bound to principles, I'm bound to truth, I'm married to the religion of natural law, which is nature's. That's an inner binding and inner self-discipline. And that is what we want. That is good. So religion in the internal form is of positive. It should be a positive thing. In the external form, when you're taking someone else's religion, it can never work out well. Right.
And you're absolutely right. Yeah. In the positive sense, it binds us back to truth itself. In the negative sense, it's binding us to external dogma.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. And then concerning the term natural law, we were aware that there's a lot of ambiguity about that term, or both terms in that phrase, natural law. A law is immutable, which means it cannot be man-made. It cannot be altered or created by man. If it is, then that is not a law. That is something else. That is a rule. That is a code. That is a dictate. An edict. There's a million terms for it, but it's not law, because a law is immutable. And then the natural, obviously, that word is corrupted too, because people immediately associate that with Darwinism and, you know, the lion attacking a gazelle in the field or whatever. And then, you know, Darwinism and a social order, survival of the most
the fittest,
ruthless. Right. Yeah, survival of the fittest translates to survival of the most ruthless. But I think that's, you know, we do need to unite on natural law. And we all have the capacity to understand and take responsibility for these principles, which we've got to do, or we're going to, you know, we're either going to serve truth. See, that's the hard thing that nobody wants to hear, is that freedom itself means responsibility to truth. So nobody really wants that. And we're either going to serve truth or we're going to serve man. And that's a cookbook. So that's what we really have to come to terms with. And I don't want to sound discouraging. I don't want to discourage people, but and don't think of it as work. You know, the whole point is just to enjoy yourself. But you're only going to enjoy yourself when you take pride in your effort and take pride, especially in your research.
Yeah, you got to know it's true deep in your heart, not because Douglas said so, or Mark Passio said so, or Chris said so, or the Rosicrucians or the Egyptians. It's true because you discover that it exists everywhere in reality. The Scottish guy, Rutherford, wrote the book about Lex Rex, and that idea of Lex Rex is the law is king.
That's right.
And there can be no king over the law itself. And so it's up to you to study, understand, and learn how that relates in context to yourself and create your inner religion and code of conduct based on that cornerstone that reality gives us, you know. So that's kind of where I'll end what I want to say. The floor is yours, Douglas. Feel free to close up however you please, and then we'll come back and do another episode and zone in a little more.
Well, that was very inspiring the way you put that. So I'm going to let that be the closing thoughts for the show. You can find my work at thecubbyhole.com. And I've got a new show coming out with Francesco Sani and Ivan Oelo where we just explore all different kinds of soundtracks. It's going to be a really long show. And then now I've got this show coming out.
Where can people find that? On YouTube or the one?
Well, it'll be on. You probably got to follow Francesco Sani from the One Great Work Network or Ivan Oelo from the One Great Network. I don't know if they'll put that show on the network, but
you can find their links.
I have an Odyssey page. You can find it there. I think it's Axmax on Odyssey. It's going to be, but you know, you can find my Odyssey page from the One Great Work Network, and then from there you can
absolutely
find my other work. I'll post that on there. But you know, I'm more concerned about, you know, the serious shows. The show I got coming out with Nate is pretty lengthy, and we go a lot more in depth into these types of subjects. I just did over a 3-hour show with Nate, and we really got deeper into some of this stuff. But this was a great icebreaker for me to get back on here with you, Chris, and I have to get back on in the very near future, and we'll continue on these very difficult subjects and try to bring some more clarity to it. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be on here, and I really love the way you summarized it there at the end, so I won't try to expound on that. So thanks a lot, and thanks everybody for listening.
Appreciate it. Yeah, Douglas, you're a superstar. You're a hero to me. Been a big inspiration, and I don't think I'd be able to talk about some of these topics the way I can if I hadn't studied your work. So
thanks.
Check out Nate Capp's channel, cubbyhole.com. That's WHOLE.com and onegreatworknetwork.com. And we'll see you guys soon. Thanks for coming. Evil is the destruction of freedom.
Thank you.